It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host this morning. This morning, we're going to be talking about law enforcement safety and what the government is doing about that and what some other groups are doing about it. And to help us talk about that, I'd like to welcome a regular, somewhat regular on Fed Talk, Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Craig, welcome to Fed Talk.
Good morning, Bill.
And also from the Department of Justice, Jim Birch, who's the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Justice Programs. Jim, welcome to Fed Talk.
Thanks, Bill. Good morning.
Craig, tell us a little bit about what your organization does to promote law enforcement safety.
Well, Bill, we started in 1984, and at that point in time, our sole mission in life was to build a National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, a monument that would honor the service and the sacrifice that law enforcement officers make throughout this country's history. And we've done that. We dedicated that memorial in 1991. It sits in a place called Judiciary Square, the 400 block of E Street, Northwest Washington. In fact, there's a subway stop right there on the Red Line called Judiciary Square. You come right up into our memorial. And on the walls of that memorial are the names of 19,660 names of officers who've been killed in the line of duty dating back to the first death in 1791. Actually, that was a sheriff in upstate New York, Columbia County, named Cornelius Hogaboom, who was shot and killed more than 200 years ago. And we're talking about Cornelius Hogaboom today and always. And every officer who's died in the line of duty since then, we've documented. We've honored them by putting their names on that memorial. And every year, we come out with an annual report talking about the number of officers who've been killed in the line of duty. We do that basically to make sure we never take their service and their sacrifice for granted. The people of this country need to understand that there are 800,000 sworn federal, state, and local officers out there every day putting their lives at risk for our safety and our protection. And unfortunately, on average, about 154 officers die every year in the performance of duty. And we were very pleased to be able to report this past year that the numbers had gone down dramatically from the previous couple of years when we saw a sharp spike in the number of officers killed in the line of duty.
So, Jim, I've heard Craig talk about law enforcement safety and what his group has done, and especially recognizing the fallen law enforcement. But it's interesting to me to have you on as part of the government actually promoting law enforcement safety, not just for federal law enforcement, but throughout the country. Can you talk a little bit about what you all do?
I'd be glad to, Bill. In fact, this is really the outgrowth of a great partnership that we've had with the Law Enforcement Memorial. The Office of Justice Programs and all of the offices within our agency, including the Bureau of Justice Assistance, the National Institute of Justice, for example, are a little bit different from all of the other components in the Department of Justice. Our sole mission is to support state and local law enforcement to improve their safety, to improve their effectiveness, and to improve their efficiency. That's what we do. That's the only thing we focus on within DOJ. So the way we go about doing that is within OJP, we have agencies that concentrate on research and technology, and that research and that technology really drives what we do in terms of how we help state and local law enforcement. That's what we hope to talk about here today.
Okay. Can you give me some of the types of projects that you're working on?
Well, so example being in the area of law enforcement safety, we have a national training program. You know, on the Law Enforcement Memorial, one of the quotes that's inscribed there on that memorial is, "In Valor, there is hope." One of the programs that we have that we'd like to talk about today is a program called Valor. Valor, in this case, stands for Preventing Violence Against Law Enforcement and Ensuring Officer Resilience. This is a training program that was developed by research that was conducted through our National Institute of Justice together with the FBI. Went out and looked at all of the previous incidents where law enforcement officers were killed in the line of duty or assaulted in the line of duty to try to help us understand the deadly mix of three things: the officers, the suspects, and the circumstances that bring them together. And the thinking is, if we can train an officer to be able to understand and know when that deadly mix may be occurring, when their life may be threatened or their safety may be threatened, we can then give them the tools to avoid that situation or to prevent injury or other harm. And so that training is really based on the research that was done. We've been doing training now regionally as well as locally around the country. We've trained thousands of local law enforcement officers to date. And this was really in response to what we saw from Craig's data and other data, a huge increase in the number of law enforcement officers killed and assaulted in 2011, 2012. So we really began to take action quickly to address that issue. In the Valor program, we also train them on how to identify armed gunmen, how to know when there's someone they may be in the presence of who is carrying a concealed weapon that may be used against them. We train them in that. We train them in techniques such as battlefield first aid, for example, to understand life-saving techniques that they may have to deploy to save their own life or their partner's life. And we train them in high-risk tactical type situations, such as how to handle active shooter situations, such as we saw historically in the Columbine situation many, many years ago. And we train them in something called the warrior spirit, understanding how to have the right mindset, awareness, and image to prevent these kinds of deadly mixes from occurring. We do this in partnership with, as I mentioned, Craig's group, the Law Enforcement Memorial. We do it in partnership with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, located here in Alexandria. And we do it in partnership with federal agencies such as the FBI, which has an interest in this issue as well.
So, Craig, have you seen some results from these programs?
Absolutely, Bill, and I have to give credit where credit's due. The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, for the last several years has made law enforcement safety a top priority of his personally and the Department of Justice. As a result, Jim mentions one very important program that we partner with and we receive some grant money from, and that's the Valor program. But he's also met with law enforcement leaders in his office. I was privileged to be part of a group about 2 years ago when the spike in law enforcement fatalities had troubled all of us and alarmed the Attorney General. So he brought in all the leaders across the country, a number of them, sat him in his office and took page after page of notes about what we possibly might be able to do to save officers' lives that were being lost. And he created something called a National Officer Safety and Wellness Group. I'm proud to be a part of that working group. There's about 40 of us that sit and meet every 3 months or so. And we talk about ways we can make it safer for our officers. But we also talk about issues like police suicides, which are much higher than the norm. We talk about how officers can stay fit, physically fit, as well as mentally fit. They deal with a lot of stress on the job. So we've got to address that part of the equation as well. So as a result, all of this laser-like focus on officer safety and wellness, we saw a 23% decrease in the number of officers killed in the line of duty this past year. And I'm very proud and pleased to be able to say here today, as I knock on some wood, that there has not been a single law enforcement fatality during the first 11 days of this year.
Okay, well, those are some encouraging statistics going in the right direction. Can you do you attribute it to these programs, that this training, this Valor program, these other initiatives, or do you think there's something else possibly that's causing it?
Without question, it's this focus on law enforcement safety from the highest levels of government, the Attorney General on down, that has made the difference. Unfortunately, like so many agencies and departments across this country, federal, state, and local government, law enforcement has been hurt by the budget cuts that have occurred these last few years. There's fewer officers on the street, there's less technology, there's less equipment, and there's less training, unfortunately, because all of that costs money. And money has been very precious these past few years. So what law enforcement has been forced to do is get smarter. And that means they're better preparing their officers to do more with less. And they're approaching these potentially life-threatening situations in a much more cautious manner. They're better prepared to deal with these life-threatening moments.
Jim, how long has this justice program's, how long have you been doing this, trying to train the local, state and local law enforcement into better, safer ways of doing business?
Well, the Valor Training Program has been in existence since 2009. But our history in this area, if you will, goes back all the way to 1975, when our National Institute of Justice first began testing and developing standards for law enforcement body armor. And so I think we have a long and rich history of supporting these kinds of initiatives. The Officer Safety and Wellness Group that that Craig talked about is something that I think is worthy of further discussion. It really is a broad group, as the Attorney General asked us to bring together the law enforcement associations, law enforcement agencies, researchers, and even labor organizations such as the National Fraternal Order of Police to come together and talk about the gaps in research, the gaps in training, gaps in policies and procedures, for example. And the issue that Craig touched on, this issue of physical health and wellness, is important. As I look at Craig's data, one of the, I believe it's the third highest cause of death has to do with job-related illness. And so this is an important issue that we have to focus on right behind firearms-related fatalities and automobile incidents. This job-related illness issue is a top concern.
You're listening to Fed Talk on 1500 AM Federal News Radio. We'll be right back after this short break.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Bill Bransford. Today I'm talking with Jim Birch from the Office of Justice Programs and Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. And we're talking about law enforcement safety, and we're talking about what the government, what the federal government is doing to encourage law enforcement safety throughout the United States at the state, local, and federal government. If you have a question you'd like to talk to us about this, you can give us a call toll free 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Craig, you opened a door about resources and talked about, we all know, I mean, we hear this every day in the news about declining resources everywhere. It's a big debate in Congress. Nobody knows where that's going to go. So let me ask Jim, what, I mean, you must be on the front lines of dealing with resources for your program. Where do you see that going? And the 113th Congress, as it gets started, how has been the level of congressional support been for your program up until now?
Well, thanks, Bill. I think in terms of where we end up with fiscal year 13, that's going to remain to be seen. As you know, we're under a continuing resolution currently. But I will say that we've enjoyed some absolutely phenomenal support from both sides of the aisle on Capitol Hill around these issues. Going many, many years back, 1998, Senator Leahy and the members of the Law Enforcement Caucus and others supported the Bulletproof Vest Partnership Grant Program, which I'd like to talk a little bit about later. But since that time, for programs such as Valor, for example, even in this most difficult budget environment, we've gotten fabulous support from members of Capitol Hill, Senator Mikulski, Senator Coons, former Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Congressman Frank Wolf from here in this area has been an absolute stalwart in supporting these efforts. I mean, you can't ask for a better supporter than Congressman Wolf, and Congressman Chaka Fateh as well has been very supportive of our budget requests. Together, those folks with the law enforcement caucuses in the Senate and the House have provided absolutely tremendous support, funding support for this kind of program at a time when you wouldn't think it could be done because the budget resources are so tight.
That's very encouraging, and of course, no one knows how the current debate is going to actually end up. You know, that's we all know that that's a subject of much discussion on Capitol Hill. But it sounds like you've got reason to be encouraged that at the end of the discussion, when the CR expires and we get a budget or another CR or whatever, that your office will be doing okay.
We'll be doing okay. And the other reason for that is the Attorney General made it clear that he wants all of us in the Department of Justice to work together. And so, for example, you know, I have to give a great plug for our friends at the Office of Community-Oriented Police Services, the COPS office at DOJ, has been a great partner to us and has really come together, as Craig mentioned, the Officer Safety and Wellness Working Group. We've combined our resources to work together to make that group a reality and to continue it going.
So what is the difference between what the COPS office does and what your office does?
Well, we work very closely together. The COPS office historically has been established to promote community policing in the U.S., primarily doing that through the hiring of community policing officers. Although we work together on areas such as law enforcement safety, our grant programs generally provide law enforcement with the kinds of support that they need to implement evidence-based responses to things like officer safety concerns, mental health issues, narcotics issues, gang issues that may be present in the community. So the two offices work together in a very complementary fashion.
And Craig, while we were on our break, you mentioned there's some basic things that every law enforcement officer should know to make their work environment more safe. Can you go over some of those basics?
Yeah, four things that I'd like to focus on. And I think number one is wear your body armor. All right. And this is something
that's like a bulletproof vest.
Bullet resistant vest, we like to say, because there are bullets that can penetrate vests. And that these vests have saved more than 3,100 law enforcement lives over the last 25 years or so. So we know that they're a valuable part of the protection that officers have. The Department of Justice years ago decided to create a program called the Bulletproof Vest Partnership Act, which allows federal dollars to help supplement state and local dollars to purchase vests for their officers. Unfortunately, we're still hearing numbers around 20%, perhaps, of the officers in this country are still not being provided with a bullet-resistant vest, as hard as that is to believe. You know, we send our officers out there with a gun and a badge. We want them to protect us. We want them to confront violent felons. But in some cases, we're still not giving them the basic safety measures that they need to protect themselves. Body armor works, and more officers are wearing body armor. There was a recent study by the Police Executive Research Forum that found that 92% of the agencies surveyed today are requiring their officers to wear bullet-resistant vests while on patrol. Just 3 years ago, the percentage of agencies requiring officers to wear vests was only 59%. So we know that increased use of vests has made a difference.
And that could be one of the reasons why there are fewer fatalities.
Exactly. As more officers are wearing vests, we know that that's going to help save their lives, not only against firearms, I should point out, but in an auto crash situation, for example, where your body hits the steering column, that traumatic injury will be reduced because you're wearing that body armor.
So you have three. Yeah, it was one. No, four. You said four.
Wear the vest, number one. Number two, wear your seatbelt. All right. As we preach to the driving public, we got to preach to the officers. Sometimes they're worried about getting in and out of their car quickly. Sometimes their guns will get tangled up in the seatbelt. Sometimes they arrive on a scene where there's shots being fired. They're worried that they're going to be confined by that seatbelt, so they might be inclined not to use it at times. Wear your seatbelt. Seatbelts save lives, and that's been a big mantra of agencies and safety groups.
It's more likely to save your life if you wear your seatbelt than saving your life because of the increased mobility by not wearing a seatbelt.
Without question, and that's the message we got to drive home to the officers in this country. Drive slower, all right, and drive a little more cautiously. The goal of every officer should be get home safely at the end of your shift and be with your family, all right? Too many officers, it's in their blood. It's what they're trained to do, help save innocent people in need. A lot of times officers are dying in single car crashes because they're responding to an emergency call. Somebody needs help, and they're thinking every second could mean the difference between life or death for that innocent person. So they drive a little more recklessly, a little more faster than they probably should given the conditions. Drive slower and give them more training. Final point, and this goes to every assignment that an officer faces, never be complacent. You never know when that life-threatening moment may come if you're a law enforcement professional, but you know that it could come on the very next call. You can never let your guard down. Always expect the worst, and you'll go home safely to your family.
Okay, so Jim, at the Department of Justice, I assume you've adopted, accepted some of these basics that Craig just talked about.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't ask for a better set of reminders. In fact, they tie right in with what we've been doing.
As Craig mentioned, said earlier, you wanted to talk about the bulletproof vest or bullet-resistant vest.
Right, exactly. This was a program that was created in 1998. Since that time, over 13,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States have received funding for body armor purchases as a result of this program. In fact, just a couple of months ago, we were able to go up to Capitol Hill again with Senator Leahy and Senator Coons to celebrate the fact that over 1 million vests have been provided to law enforcement officers in the U.S. as a result of this program, which was a substantial milestone for us. Just to give you some idea of this program's effectiveness, in fiscal year 12, we provided funding to over 4,000 law enforcement agencies. Over $20 million in 1 year went to local law enforcement to purchase vests. In 2011, we know that as a result of this funding from this program, 17 law enforcement officers' lives were saved because they were wearing a vest that was purchased in part or in whole through this program.
They would have been killed if they weren't wearing their vest.
That's our assumption. They would have been killed if it weren't for the vest. 2012, 9 law enforcement officers' lives were saved as a result of wearing vests that were purchased, again, in whole or in part through this program. The mandatory wear issue that that Craig mentioned a minute ago was something that we thought long and hard about. And we previously, prior to 2011, we had no requirement. If you took our funding, you weren't required to have a mandatory wear policy. But that changed in 2011. We thought that after talking with groups such as Craig's Law Enforcement Memorial, the IACP, for example, the National Fraternal Order of Police, many other organizations, felt like if we could establish a requirement for jurisdictions that accepted federal funding for body armor, that they would have their officers wear it, as long as we allowed that local agency to adapt that policy or that requirement to their local circumstances, that would be a right way to go. And so we followed that approach. In fact, we were concerned that it would result in a reduction in the number of agencies that were applying for funding for body armor, and it did not. In fact, the following year, after we instituted this requirement, we saw the largest number of agencies applying for grant funds through the BVP program than we had seen in many years before. And then Craig's data also, you know, supports the fact that this has been, you know, widely accepted. Just the number of law enforcement agencies now, what, 92% now have requirements in place for wearing body armor. That study done by the Police Executive Research Forum with funding from our office, I think, demonstrates this was the right decision.
Now, I got the impression, and maybe this was the wrong impression, but when Craig was going through his basics, that some police officers don't like to wear their body armor. Is that true, and how do you overcome that?
Well, I will tell you, Bill, and one of the reasons why a lot of agencies have begun to require it, in addition to the stipulation by the Bulletproof Vest Partnership Act, is that too many officers the last couple of years, more than 30%, were killed in situations where they were not wearing their vests, all right? So this became kind of a battle cry among agencies across this country, is we've got to do something to make sure our officers put those vests on. It's not acceptable to think that 30% of the officer fatalities these last couple of years could have been prevented if only that officer had worn their vest at that particular time. You know, it's hard for us to sit in our air-conditioned offices during the middle of summer and say that every officer should be wearing their vest. I can't imagine why they wouldn't. In the old days, vests used to be much bulkier. They didn't allow breathability, so the heat was kept in.
Well, they were heavy.
They were heavy. They were uncomfortable. They were hot. And when you worked in some of the hottest places in this country, Arizona, Florida, you name it, officers were a little more reluctant to wear their vests. They were willing to take their chances. And, you know, the odds say that only 1 out of 6,000 is going to get killed in the line of duty. You might say that's a lot, but I think a lot of officers were willing to bet that they'd make it home safely without putting that vest on. I think that mindset is now changing because of these requirements and because of the fact that more officers realize the risks that they do face on a daily basis.
Jim, has the Department of Justice done anything to make these bullet-resistant vests more comfortable and more acceptable to police officers to use?
We are, Bill. We're working hard on that through our research and testing programs. In particular, the study that we've talked about here a little bit today, conducted by PERF, found that one of
What's
the most—
What's PERF?
PERF is Police Executive Research Forum.
Okay.
Here in D.C., one of the most significant obstacles to law enforcement officers wearing their vest is the lack of comfort. And so we know that comfort has to do with, as Craig said, the weight and the bulkiness of the vest, but it also has to do with proper fit and making sure that the vest is the right size. There's nothing worse than, you know, vest is bad enough being heavy, but being too small and heavy can't be much worse than that. So we have funded research to provide law enforcement agencies with a guide on selection, procurement, care, and maintenance of vests. For example, one of the things we've learned through talking with law enforcement agencies and officers is many times mistakes are made, and people think, well, I can throw my vest in the washing machine and clean it up, or I can leave it in the trunk of my car where it's exposed to heat, or the back seat of my car where it's exposed to heat and UV rays. And we know that these things tend to break down the protective factors of the vest. So this research that we're funding, we hope, will result in us being able to better educate law enforcement agencies on how to care and maintain those vests. We're also funding research on how to develop vests that can fit some of the diverse populations that we're seeing today in law enforcement. So, for example, female officers need a different type of vest than male officers do. And so we need to accommodate that in our measurement, in our fit and care and maintenance. And so we're funding research along those lines as well. The other thing that we're doing is looking at the vulnerabilities that are still existing, even with a vest being on. And so understanding, you know, in places where a vest has not protected an officer's life, Where was that officer injured by the round, and how do we address those vulnerabilities, whether it's under the arm or around the neck? How do we build a better vest, in other words?
We're talking about law enforcement safety. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host this morning, and we're talking about law enforcement safety with Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Association and Jim Birch from the Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs. One of the things you mentioned was getting police officers to wear their safety belts, and I remember back a couple decades ago when mandatory seatbelt use laws first came in, and my dad just resisting that because he just didn't want to be restrained, and now it seems like you feel if you're driving a car and you don't have your seatbelt on, it feels like you're naked, you know, because you've gotten used to that. So, yeah, I mean, how hard is it to get the police officer to use a seatbelt? They're so easy to put on and take off, it seems to me, once you get used to them.
Well, it's easy for us, but we don't wear a duty belt, all right? We don't have a gun that sits right where our seatbelt clicks. And as a result, we really haven't done a good job, the society in general, but the auto industry in particular, at creating a restraint system that's uniquely suited for the law enforcement officer. who has certain requirements that the rest of us don't, and certain cumbersome duty belts that they have to wear. So as a result, some officers have chosen not to wear their seatbelts all the time. And unfortunately, studies have shown that a lot of those officers who do die in auto crashes were not wearing their seatbelts. This is an issue that has really come to the forefront of late. Mm-hmm. And more agencies are requiring their officers to wear their seatbelts. And frankly, more officers are wearing their seatbelts. That's why I think this past year we saw a 17% decrease in the number of officers killed in traffic-related incidents.
It's an interesting dichotomy, Craig, because it seems to me that police officers who come on the scene of a car accident where someone is ejected because they're not wearing their seatbelt, and then they see someone survive a much worse accident, and because they are wearing their seatbelt, they'd be the first ones to understand the importance of wearing the seatbelt. And yet there's this comfort level and feeling. What has your office done, Jim, to help with seatbelt use?
So this is an area where our National Institute of Justice, which serves as the research and development arm for the Department of Justice, has partnered with other agencies, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, part of DOT. Those folks are partnering with Craig as well on a number of highway safety issues and vehicle safety issues. But we're funding research into a number of areas that are related to what we've been talking about here today. For example, as officers are given more and more technology in patrol cars, more and more things to distract their attention as they're driving, we want to understand how that may or may not relate to auto crashes. And so we're funding research into this issue of distraction, driver distraction. You know, think about how many states have no texting laws, yet we give law enforcement officers a mobile data terminal or MDT and require them to respond back to dispatches through their MDT or through the radio, which also requires their hands off of a wheel typically. We're funding research into the factors that lead to crashes, both direct factors as well as indirect factors. That could be things like seatbelts. It could be things like distractions. We're also funding research into the extent to which equipment is placed in the patrol car appropriately. And so we have tactical or safety considerations about to what extent is an officer boxed in. Are they able to escape the vehicle if they need to? But we also have to think about the implications of the placement of that equipment for when a crash occurs. So, for example, how many times have any of us told members of our family not to put something in the back window of the car because in an accident that becomes a projectile? We have to think about the same thing with law enforcement officers. They've got a laptop, they've got a radio, they've got all sorts of other equipment, usually a lot of notebooks, sometimes briefcases and things, manuals. Those can all become projectiles. So we have to think about the extent to which those factors relate to injuries as well. We need to look at the issue of lighting, marking, and painting of police vehicles. You know, this issue of roadside injury is something that we are really focused on, knowing how many law enforcement officers are killed in the line of duty when they're working on the side of the road to assist a disabled motorist or respond to an automobile accident. And then one of the most exciting things that I think we're doing is testing some technology. Hopefully, we'll know more about this in years to come, that may alert a law enforcement officer when she or he is working on the side of the road and a vehicle is headed in their direction. It may sound an alert to the driver of the vehicle that's approaching, or it may sound an alert for the officer on the side of the road so that they have advance notice to leave the immediate lane to get out of the traffic and hopefully prevent death. So this is some of the most important research I think we could be funding in the Department of Justice.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that you have a policy requiring mandatory use of body armor if someone takes federal funds. Does the department also require mandatory seatbelt use if someone takes federal funds?
We currently don't, and that's something that we've been looking at for quite a while. I think one of the things that we have wanted to do is to understand what research tells us about restraint systems or seatbelt systems. We want to make sure that we don't, by requiring some sort of a mandatory seatbelt use program, that we don't create another safety hazard of some kind. So, Craig talked to us a couple of years ago about, in fact, encouraged us, look at the kinds of restraint systems that NASCAR uses, for example, that have quick release type functions, and understand if that's a possibility for law enforcement. We need to think about that, I think, before we make that kind of a general requirement.
Are those things you're looking at? I mean, as Craig was talking about the cumbersomeness of the seatbelt, given the officers, where their gun is and where their duty belt is and all of that, it seemed like perhaps there's a way of designing seatbelts for police officers. Are you looking into that? Is that something that maybe is down the road a little bit?
Those are exactly the kinds of things that we are looking at and want to continue to look at until we can get some definitive information about how best to make this kind of change. But we recognize that the safety of officers is paramount. And so we will not hesitate to take the appropriate decision when that time comes. As soon as we have all the information available to us to make the best decision, that's what we'll do.
So what happens? What does the Justice Department do if a police officer is killed in the line of duty? Do you have anything to help that family to deal with that?
We do, Bill. And in fact, this is a place where we partner with the Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, as well as the National Fraternal Order of Police and organizations such as Concerns of Police Survivors, for example, to provide peer support. That's the first thing we want to do, is provide peer support for not only the families, but also the coworkers of those officers. That's a critical piece of the first response, if you will. But after that initial response, we do have programs. For example, our Public Safety Officers Benefits Program, or PSOB as we call it, is a great partnership between organizations such as IACP. Even the firefighters are covered by this program, and other first responders, EMTs.
How does that program work?
Well, this is a funding program. So if an officer is killed in the line of duty, that officer's family is entitled to a federal benefit payment. This year, the payment is adjusted for inflationary figures, for example. But this year, it's $320,000, a little over $320,000 that's paid to the family.
For example, a lump sum?
It is a lump sum payment. In fiscal year 12, we paid out $66 million in claims. Those were not all claims from deaths that occurred in 2012. Many of them may have occurred in years prior. But we also will pay disability benefits if an officer is permanently and totally disabled as a result of a line of duty injury. We will pay disability claims. For example, in 2012, we paid about $10 million in disability claims. And then one of the programs that I'm most proud of is a program to provide educational benefits for the family of fallen officers. And so, for example, if a law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty, we will pay educational benefits for their family members to receive a college education. And in fiscal year 12, we paid about $500,000 in benefits to various families across the U.S.
So, Craig, is this something the National Law Enforcement Officers Fund, Memorial Fund, also gets involved in, and tell me how?
Well, our main partnership when it comes to officer fatalities occurs in two ways. One, the memorial, obviously, which we've talked about. We need to honor these men and women that have given their lives for our public safety. We're building a national museum so that the stories, the inspiring stories of those men and women who have made the ultimate
sacrifice. When's your
museum
projected to open?
Spring of 2015. We're getting near the finish line.
Almost two years from now.
Yeah, and it'll be about a 15-year project at that point. Congress authorized that museum to be built in 2000. But it wasn't enough just to put the names of these officers on the walls of the memorial. We wanted to tell the stories behind those names, and we wanted to tell the complete story of law enforcement and their history here in this country of ours. They've been such a vital part of creating the society that we live in. We need to tell that story. We also partner with Justice, with the Concerns of Police Survivors, with the Fraternal Order of Police and their auxiliary, and other groups to put on what's called National Police Week. I've been here with you many times, Bill, talking about National Police Week. It's in May. It's always the week that includes May 15th, which is Peace Officers Memorial Day. We've been commemorating that special occasion in that week since 1963, a special time of the year where we pause and say thank you to the men and women in law enforcement, and we especially acknowledge the loss of those who have given their lives in the line of duty. So we put on ceremonies that week. It's about 4 days. We have more than 25,000 people that come to Washington to participate in these events, many of them law enforcement professionals, surviving family members of the officers who've been killed in the line of duty. They're all with us as well as citizen supporters. So that's where we come in. We're always working with the Department of Justice, with so many of these other groups. We have 16 national law enforcement organizations on our board of directors, including the Concerns of Police Survivors, the self support group for family members of officers killed. And this is a partnership. This is a coalition of caring people and organizations that have done such a wonderful job, I believe, over the last 20 years or so in making sure that the loss of an officer is never forgotten and that the families of those men and women who've suffered that terrible loss are taken care of.
And you said something earlier, Craig, about creating a mentality where people don't expect that there would be any loss of life in law enforcement.
We need to create a culture of safety, Bill. We're too accepting as a society and even as the law enforcement profession. We assume it's part of the job. People are going to get injured. People are going to get killed. So we think that way. We need to think differently. We need to turn that upside down on its head and realize that any injury, any death is one too many, and we should never accept it, and we should do everything in our power to prevent it.
Okay, this is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host this morning, and with me on Fed Talk is Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund and Jim Birch from the Department of Justice, Office of Justice Programs. We're talking about law enforcement safety. Earlier, Craig, you were talking about some wellness programs, and you were talking about the fact that the law enforcement officers have a higher suicide rate than the general public. Tell me a little bit about how these wellness programs work.
Well, thankfully, Bill, over the years, law enforcement agencies have done a much better job of providing counseling to their officers. Many of these officers suffer through post-traumatic stress disorder, similar to what our soldiers face when they go to war. All right, you see things that most of us never see in our lives. All right, it's a horror movie, only it's real. And then they have to deal with that, maybe a colleague's death, for example, or taking the life of another human being, even though that person may have been a drug-crazed killer with a gun that officer had to shoot and kill to protect themselves and other innocent people. But then they have to go home and try to live a normal life with their family. It's tough to do. You can't just turn that switch on and off. And so as a result, what happens is we need to provide counseling for these men and women who face these very difficult and dangerous situations. Many agencies today require officers to have counseling when there's an officer-involved shooting, for example. That didn't used to be the case.
But at one point, there was a stigma for that, wasn't there?
Well, exactly. It's a chink in your armor.
Maybe a little bit of a stigma still.
And I think so. I think that you realize the men and women in law enforcement are, most of us think of them as supermen, you know, and a lot of them think of themselves as supermen. And that's why they drive fast and face dangerous situations and don't have the normal fear that the rest of us do. All right. They're wired a little differently than the rest of us. And it takes a lot of good training to try to keep them from going over the edge. But seeing all these terrible things in life that they have to deal with, they need counseling. Counseling is being provided in greater numbers, but even so, because of the stress of the job, the incidence of police suicide is much higher than the norm, and we've got to get our head around that problem.
What is the justice programs doing about this, Jim?
So we've partnered with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, again here in the D.C. area, to develop a media campaign or an awareness campaign. We've published a CD that's been sent out to law enforcement agencies across the U.S., to educate them on this problem. The other thing that we've done is we partnered some time ago with our friends over in Prince George's County, Maryland, PG County Police Department, to do some training throughout the state on a peer support model. One of the things, you know, Craig talked about the fact that law enforcement is not known as a profession that's willing to reach outside of the agency or outside of the walls to get the support or the help that's needed. And so this model, I think, is a very good answer to that, where you're training other law enforcement officers on how to recognize the symptoms of a potential problem and how to initially intervene to make sure that person gets the kind of support and the assistance that they need. And so we provided that training, and I understand that folks in Prince George's County went on to provide that training to others in Montgomery County, Maryland, for example, and elsewhere. So that's a very promising model that I think we need to look at more in the future.
I've actually had the privilege of being at some federal law enforcement facilities where I've seen the very, very strong emphasis on physical fitness. And sometimes when I see a state or a local policeman, I'm not so sure I see that behind that person is that same intensity for physical fitness. Is this something that you're pushing, being physically fit? Because it seems to me that would be something that would also play into law enforcement safety.
Well, it's not something that the department is pushing necessarily. It is an issue, though, we want to look at further. And so we did, again, partner with the International Association of Chiefs of Police to develop an injury database where agencies and officers could go in and report on-the-job injuries that have occurred and to assess to what extent other factors may have played a role in that. And so, you know, wellness in this case, as you suggest, is one of the things that
physical
we
fitness,
understand.
For example,
physical fitness
so
as well.
We want that might have contributed to someone's injury or
absolutely,
or death.
Absolutely. So we're hoping that over time that data will give us a better opportunity to understand this issue and to be able to help address it.
You know, a major statistic, Bill, is that there are more than 800 officers whose names are on the National Memorial who died from heart attacks. All right. Heart attacks are a big part of the job and is certainly a major concern. Stress can kill. All right. Studies have shown that. And when you're involved in a pursuit, whether it be in your vehicle or on foot, or you're involved in a struggle with an armed felon, these can be very stressful situations. And unfortunately, when you go from a resting heart rate and all of a sudden now you're involved in a high-speed pursuit or you're chasing a dangerous felon who's just raped someone, your heart rate goes up tremendously, puts a lot of stress on your heart, and sometimes that stress kills.
And sometimes someone who's even physically fit can have that problem. But I guess if you're not physically fit, that puts even more stress on the heart.
Absolutely. And that's why we're seeing more and more agencies put in physical fitness training programs for their officers. They pay them to work out during their shift because they know that that's going to make them a better officer and it's going to give them a better chance to survive this very difficult profession.
Now, I've seen some, like I said, I've seen that on the federal level, and it's very, very impressive. And it seems like it would work at all levels of law enforcement if everybody did that. One of the things, you know, this most recent year was a better year, I think. Can you give me some specific breakdowns, the number of people that were killed, how they were killed, that and especially the number of federal law enforcement, since this is a Fed Talk is the name of our show.
Absolutely. And it was great news that we were able to report at the end of the year. For 2012, there was 127 law enforcement officers who were killed in the line of duty. That's based on preliminary information. That number may go up or down a little bit as we dig deeper into those cases. But the good news is that that's the second lowest fatality figure we've seen in 50 years for law enforcement officers, all right? The only year that was any better was 2009 when we lost 122 officers. You remember earlier in the program, I mentioned the average number of officers killed each year is 154 over the last decade. So this number that we saw in 2012, far below that figure. When it comes to the causes of deaths last year, the number one category of death, unfortunately, for the 14th out of the last 15 years, was traffic-related incidents. 50 officers killed in traffic-related incidents. 30 of them died in auto crashes. We had 14 who were struck and killed while outside of their vehicle. And by the way, Bill, there's a great law that's been enacted by 49 out of the 50 states. It says if you see an emergency vehicle on the side of the roadway, that you must slow down, and if you have the option, move over a lane to give that officer an added margin of safety. So that those laws have certainly helped save a lot of police
lives.
I'm
not sure everyone knows that law.
I agree.
Could be publicized a little bit more.
In fact, there was a survey recently, 70% or more of the population was unaware that there was such a law. So we have a lot of work to do in that area. Six officers were actually killed in motorcycle crashes, another very dangerous job that officers do. In fact, one officer was part of President Obama's entourage when he was actually killed in a motorcycle crash. So these were some of the major causes of death. Last year, firearms. With all the talk about gun violence in our country of late, we can't ignore the fact that 40 officers were shot and killed during 2012. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that's a 32% decrease from the 72 officers who were shot and killed in 2011.
Okay. And the number of federal law enforcement that...
federal officers killed last year, nine. Nine federal agents.
And how does that stack up to what we usually see?
Well, the last couple of years, we saw nine in 2010, 12 in 2011. So it was a decrease again from the prior year. Terrell Horn from the Coast Guard, David Delaney from the Border Patrol, Nicholas Ivey, Border Patrol, Jeffrey Ramirez from the Border Patrol. They took a lot of hits last year, as they often do.
Border Patrol can be a dangerous job.
Very dangerous. Preston Parnell, U.S. Postal Inspection Service. James Dominguez, U.S. Border Patrol. Leopoldo Cavazos Jr., Border Patrol. Julio La Rosa from the Department of the Treasury. Margaret Anderson, and we all remember her as we start a new year. She was the park ranger who was killed during a traffic stop, shot and killed last January 1st on New Year's Day. And those were the nine federal agents we lost in 2012.
And as you say, there hasn't been so far this year a law enforcement officer fatality.
Thank goodness. And again, it's the longest streak I've seen in my 30 years plus that I've been doing this job. I haven't ever seen this long a period go by without a single fatality during the start of a year. And we can only hope and pray that this trend continues.
Jim, what's on the horizon for justice programs? What do you see? What do you see your next big initiative being?
Well, I think we're going to continue down the path that we have been working on. The Officer Safety and Wellness Group that Craig talked a little bit about is going to continue to focus on their priorities. The injuries as a result of gunfire, looking into this issue of ambush situations, if you will. They're going to be looking at leadership and safety practices. Craig talked about the culture of safety that's needed. And they're also going to continue to look at both the physical health issues as well as the psychological health issues that we see surfacing time and time again in the law enforcement.
And these are things that you actually have give grants to have people research, and then you provide money to local law enforcement so that they can take the benefit of this research.
Right. We either have research funded in this area or we have a training program that's already delivering services to address some of these issues. But part of the purpose of this working group is to also identify gaps, places where we need to do more. And so we have to always be open to that. We don't necessarily have all the answers.
And how do you do your coordination with all those thousands of local law enforcement offices? That must be an enormous task in and of itself.
Well, that's why I think we're fortunate to have partners like Craig and Bart Johnson over at the International Association of Chiefs of Police and Chuck Wexler at the Police Executive Research Forum. Those folks represent many of these local agencies and surface their views and their issues back to us. And so it's through them and also through direct dialogue with agencies that we encounter that we learn about these kinds of perspectives.
We have over 100,000 law enforcement agencies, organizations, and individual practitioners that we communicate with on a regular basis, usually once, twice a week. We'll get them an important message out there, whether it be our fatality report or Valor training program opportunities, and that's a very valuable part. With the technology we have today, we can communicate a lot better than we used to.
Well, it sounds like we're doing a lot more than we ever have. Many thanks to Jim Birch from the Department of Justice and Craig Floyd from the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund for being with us today to talk about a very important topic, police safety. And that's all the time we have. And we'll be back next time on Fed Talk, brought to you by the attorneys at Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Have a great weekend.